Accession number 31430, Mr. Leslie Higgins, Reel 6. Now, what about, we're talking about when you, soon after you got there, you'd been selected for this water polo team. Now, tell me about your water polo activities generally.
The first match we played, I was placed in goal. Don't know why, they just decided I should make a good goalie. Probably because I played water polo quite a lot, you know. Some of them hadn't played water polo, but they said, you know, oh yeah, something to, let's get out and do something different, which they did. So I played in goal and defended. I think our first game was a 3-3, so I defended fairly well, but I did have a word with the captain of the team and said that, you know, I don't like being in goal. I prefer to be on the left wing. That was my major position. So the matches after, I played left wing, and quite successfully. I've got paper cuttings in my cupboard in there from what they used to do, an old newsletter. And there's one match there where I scored 9 goals in 5 minutes. It was a fabulous game for me anyway. Yeah, 9 goals, 5 minutes. But I always scored goals from that position. And our captain's name was... what was his name now? I can't remember.
No, come back to you. Now, was this just for... Who was this for?
This was the Japan Reinforcement Base Depot.
That
was where all the squaddies went before they really went into Korea. Or when they came home on leave, they got sent into to this base camp. It was... we used to call it the cattle station because it's where they collected all the Mavericks up and then sent them on the trail somewhere, which was always out to Korea.
And was it a mixed rank?
Yeah. Now, I found intriguing because I was the only private in the team. It was all from corporal up. And our captain... Captain Niven, that was his name. He was the medical officer of the camp, Captain Niven. Said at the beginning of the outset that when we're in the water, we're all equal. But I want you to respect ranks when you're out of the water and talking to or within an area of other ranks being present. Which I thought was quite nice. And he was a very nice... very nice officer. Used to get us excuse a lot of parades because they're always having parades for one reason or another. And he used to say, "Oh, you're swimming tomorrow, aren't you? What did you do today? You fell over and damaged your knee, or you bent your thumb back and on in the pool, or you the ball hit you and in the eye and you can't see properly." And he used to take us off of all these guard duties, which was smashing.
And he was medical officer, so
yeah,
he could.
Yeah, he was medical, yeah. He was a great guy. He was.
And who would you play? I mean...
We played other camps. We played the Signals Regiment, the Tank Regiment, some other Air Army, particularly the Americans, Royal Australian Air Force... Royal Australian Navy. This is what we were actually picked for. But if we went to play from Koori, we used to go right the way up to a place called Iwakuni, which is in somewhere up the line in Japan, and they used to take us by motor torpedo boat. This was our day out. We used to leave at 8 o'clock in the morning, go all the way there, which was about 4 or 5 hours at sea, play the water polo match, have our dinner, then come 4 or 5 hours back on the decks of this motor torpedo boat, which was fabulous. You know, it's like getting in the boxing team. If you box, everything was hunky-dory. But we were a war polo team.
Now, where were you actually living? I mean, you'd gone from Busan for this. Did you then stay in Koori?
I stayed in Koori, in JRBD for... I used to go backwards and forwards, which I can tell you about. But we... carried on playing through the season, and then we used to play a camp called British Base Signals Regiment. British Base Signals Regiment, yeah. Now, the captain of their team was called Captain Dyson, which was captain by rank, captain by nature. But what we didn't know, and why we could never beat him, we never beat him, funny enough, he was in the 1948 New Zealand Olympic swimming team as a water polo team captain. He took us towards the end of the season and said that you've been selected to swim for the British Commonwealth against America in a water polo match, again in Iwakuni. So I was picked to play left wing on that game, and we beat the Americans, strange enough, 13-1. And I only scored one goal that day because Dyson was at his best, you know. But fabulous game, but it knocked him silly. The Yanks didn't like it. But there you are, that's the game. And then that was the last game of the season because we were the season swimming team that ended then.
Now how long would that last for, from August to...
August, September, October. By November, the water was getting quite cold.
And did you stay at Cure all that time?
During the swimming times, I used to go on the Wosang and the Yisang, taking documents out for particular, say like in Busan, you'd been put on a charge, court martial case, for instance. They would contact number one independent field records and say we want all the documents of private Hart so-and-so number, whatever, and with all the documents would all be put together and they'd be given to you in a satchel, and that was you're
acting as a messenger
taking these things to
and that gave you an excuse to play
and that was backwards and forwards water polo. As long as the matches were on, we played. That was one of the things. Once you got in the team, then you were, and nothing else was put in the way of it.
Now, anything else about water polo? Was that, that's the climax of that?
No, the only other thing was being, every time we were in anywhere near the pool in Curie, which is where the swimming pool was, we had what they call pool duty. And we used to be in swimmers, lifesavers. And we also gave the guys eardrops because there was always a little bug that used to live on the top of the surface of the water, and it would give you tinea, I think they called it, or something like that, in ears. Very bad sores in ears. Our job was to make sure everybody had this in their ears before they went in the water and save them if they drowned. You know, that was the duties. But we were, as a team, we were given the use of the swimming pool in the afternoons from 3 o'clock till 4 o'clock. To train, so we used to do our swimming, just swim 40 lengths or whatever it was, and then finish half an hour of ball play with the ball and goal, you know. But that was my swimming career.
So getting back to what about your duties then? How did that go?
Well, I just did the duties as and when they came up. When there was nothing going on, we were normally co-opted into guard duties in Busan or guard duties in Curie, because we never really had a regiment to say, well, this is, I know I was an Essex regiment man, would never want to be anything else, but we were always there filling in spaces that cropped up at different times.
Now, what were your living conditions like in Busan? Where you must have been there most of the time.
Most of the time it was
just in that big shed, were you? Or did
we went to like bivouac things, which were
tents,
half tent and half wood. And then
what were they like? Can you describe a bit more, because the weather starts to get worse.
Well, in the summer they were lovely because you had the canvas top, you could fold up all the sides and you could let the fresh air in and out, but it was all wood against the under weather, so to speak, and you had 3 or 4 steps up to them. That was that kind of thing. But then during the winter, I'm just trying to think where I was in the winter of 53. I've been moved back to Curie then.
Permanently or?
No, they were looking for people who were interested in doing a Christmas show.
Just look at the conditions at Busan a bit more. So you were in these bivouac tents. What was the food like? you know, the, or was it just normal rations?
Normal field, you know, field cookhouse and everything else. We never went, I never went short of food, and I never went short of enough. I always had appropriate amounts.
What about, did you see much of the South Koreans in Busan?
In, well, yeah, but the law was there, and our military law was that we didn't associate, you weren't allowed to associate with them, because you never knew if the South Koreans were North Koreans, so there was a bit of propaganda there. But can I?
Yep. Now tell me about volunteering for this Christmas show.
Well, they wanted volunteers who could act, play instruments, or which something which I'd never dreamed of until then was painting scenery. And I thought to myself, gosh, scenery painting, that's something to think about when I go out of the army, you know. So I volunteered as a scenery painter.
Using your artistic skills.
Yeah, as a scenery painter. Which they fell over me to do, you know. I designed sets and made things work and got scenes going. But the thing is, by the time the Christmas show was nearly ready, they hadn't got enough acts. So someone, I don't know who it was, bless them, they said to the lieutenant who was running the, directing the show, just happened to say, oh, Higgins plays the harmonica. So Higgins got elected to be roped in on one of the scenes playing a harmonica. But we had, eventually, we found 12 harmonicas and one piano accordion. But the piano accordion player used to play in a Scottish band. I'm trying to think of what their name was now. They were a very, very well-known accordion band in Scotland.
After the war? Before the war.
Yeah, and through the last war. And
I can't think of it.
Yeah, so if you ever think of it, it's a wonderful band. Always had piano accordions. Well, he was one of them. And another thing which was strange with him, he was a professional runner, which means on Sunday mornings in Scotland, he would be challenged to run against local talent, and that's how he earned his living. People bet on him. It's like greyhound racing. But he was a professional runner. His name was Simpson, and he was a piano accordion player, and I just can't remember the name of him.
And what was the show like?
Great. Had some good stuff. Some really good stuff.
So did you have to build your own theatre, or was it, you know...
We made our theatres where they were, although in Currie they had a proper, called Gloucester Theatre, which was named after the Royal Gloucesters that were punished in Korea. But that was a proper theatre. But when we went to play this thing, we did it Christmas, and we were asked to go to the hospital in Currie. We had to do it in... We got one ward, and they got the doors open to make the mouth of the set or the stage, and everything in the corridors and the rooms outside of that were all the changing rooms and dressing rooms. So we did play to them. But the ironic part about it was that we were supposed to have done Currie for a week, and then we went down to do the hospital for another week. And then the Japanese invited us to do it at the Korean local theatre in Currie Harbour for another week. And then the Signals Regiment wanted us, the Canadians wanted us, the Americans wanted us, and everybody wanted us, even though people like, what's the girl's name whose dress blows up and she tries... Marilyn Monroe had been out in Korea, and Bob Hope and people like that, they still wanted to see this show. And we did our last show on the last Saturday in May for that same year. We did the same show right the way through, which was fabulous. And then at the end of the closing of the show, I can remember the adjutant of Currie getting up in front of all the audience. He came up on the stage. We'd done the finale, we're all on stage, and he said, what a wonderful show it's been, etc., etc. And he said, And there is one particular member of this cast who will now be able to get his hair cut. And I've not had my hair cut since December before, because I always used to say, I'm in the show. Corporals used to shout, hey, get your hair cut. Say, I'm in the show, I've got to keep it long. And like it is now, yeah. I never had it cut all that time, which was wonderful. And then because that started getting into the summer again of the next year.
Now, did you have any other duties during that period, or was that it?
That was it. That was my duty.
So you were...
doing building scenes, changing scenes. Because if you wanted us to come to your barracks, we had to go down. We had a jeep, a driver who used to take... We just used to phone up and say, we want the jeep. They send it up from the MT, and that's motor transport. We'd be sent down to wherever we were going with the lieutenant, and he would look it over and say, well, what do you think, Higgins? You know, say, well, we could cut that scene down there and just take one table and chairs there. Because when we played the accordion scene, it was called the Place Bigal. And what it was, a bloke played the harmonica, the piano accordion underneath one of my lampposts, virtually. And he'd play it with his, you know, little blue beret, and they'd throw it on the floor and collect money. And people be sitting at the table reading papers and drinking, and waiters flitting backwards and forwards. Typical roadside cafe, you know. And then one of the boys would pick up his harmonica, who might be reading the paper, and start joining in, and then another, and then someone walking past. And gradually we got all the 12 harmonicas on the stage playing the French music. And then one chap there was brilliant. He taught me how to play the can-can polka, and he was brilliant harmonica player, you know. And we had a terrific piano player who used to play in the naffy of a night time, you know, because everywhere you go you've got a naffy. And that's how we did that show. We continued it from December right round to May. It was fabulous.
Good way to spend your national...
Oh, wonderful. Can't not mind a service. I became a champion swimmer. I became a reasonable scene director. And I became and that helped me play the harmonica. Because I always carry... I had 14 harmonicas when I came out of the army. All different sizes. And even today, I was in church yesterday. And I play in the group there. And I still play the harmonica now. So it's a long-term thing. And yet I can't read music, which is strange.
And so you wouldn't suffer much from the bad winter, I presume? Or you'd be in camp? It
just, no, when I was in the winter side of it, we were in a proper brick and proper huts with fires in the middle of them that you put on logs and whatnot.
This is at Curie?
Yeah, dried your webbing. There's about 30 blokes to a billet, I suppose. And we had, you know, proper outside showers, though they may be, but still hot water, you know, which the boys in Korea didn't get, unless it was mobile stuff, you know.
Now, so what happens next then? Yeah, because you've had this period out,
period out. I was still attached to the field records, and then took over a few duties there, and then...
Is that just guard duties then?
Just, and not necessarily guard, but you were always somewhere where you were needed.
So what kind of thing would you be
doing?
Well,
one thing that I was, which I'm always honoured to have done, was when Colonel Khan of the Gloucester Regiment was released from... Because when the ceasefire was after 90 days, then they sent us to help bring the fellas back, escort them back to off across the 38th parallel. That was another job we were doing.
Well, tell me about that.
Well, we just met them at the handover point, and we escorted them back to Pusan, got all their uniform, helped them get uniform stuff, and then we escorted them over from Pusan on one of the boats, the Isang or the Wosang, back to Curie, where they were collected all together, because they all came home, the Gloucester Regiment, most of them came home on the Astorias.
And what state was Colonel Khan? How do you know his belated? It's well known. I should know it.
I think it was C-A-R-N-N-E. I think it was Carn, or C-A-R-N-E, no double N. When they brought him back to Curie, they wanted him chaired physically on an armchair off of the vehicle at the gate and back to the officer's mess. But sadly, they couldn't find any Gloucester Regiment men. They were all down the town boozing up. So they got, again, oddbods. And I was an oddbod that got one of the pleasure, if not an honour, or even if a backache, carrying him on my shoulder with a big armchair.
What did you think of him? Well, what state was he in?
Well, he was still very drawn and gaunt then, because he hadn't had time to recuperate properly. I mean, we weren't totally aware of him. All we knew, he was a colonel of a regiment that got captured and had been undergoing some rotten treatment, you know. But to be able to pick him up on your shoulder was fantastic, you know. And the only thing they told us was to don't wear berets, because the guys who'd been issued their berets, coming from a prisoner of war camp, they hadn't had time to shrink them. So they would have been these big cowpat ones, you know. So we didn't wear our berets. And this picture appeared, I think, in the Soldier magazine. And I don't think many, many people were aware that 90% of the pole carriers, so to speak, were anybody that could have been grabbed to help out do this duty, you know, which was quite fascinating.
The next thing is the next thing when you did this battle training course.
We did. I'm just trying to. Yes, it would have been around about that time when we started the battle training. They said that all personnel that hadn't been on a battle course would have to go, whether you wanted to or not.
Where was this at?
That was called Haramura in Japan.
How do you spell that?
H A R A M U R A.
And that's a camp, is it?
Yeah, it's a battle training camp.
And what do you remember of this course? Take as much detail as you remember.
When we got there, went up by lorries, obviously. When we got there, we were met by sergeants from the Royal Australian Regiment. All Scotsmen. No Australians among them at all. But they were all Scotsmen. A real dead man's army, you know. They were the terrible... terrible hard men that had been injured, they'd been shot at, they'd been wounded, they'd been put in prison, and they were looking for something to do, you know. That was their job, Royal Australian Regiment.
And how did they treat you when you first arrived?
Rough. Oh, they were bullies. Really wild bullies.
Good bullies or bad bullies, you know.
Well, soldier bullies, you know. I mean, you had to jump when they said jump. That was it. You know, discipline. Real, real discipline. And they'd all been through the mill, obviously. But fortunately for me, whether it was fortunate or not, we were detached, or the little group of guys that I was with were attached to the Princess Patricia's Light Infantry, which were Canadians. And they would all been wounded in action and gone through that, and they were now instructors, teaching by experience, I suppose. And that was quite good training. That.
Well, tell us a bit about it. Do you remember the training, or is it modelled in with the rest of the training you did?
Basic training, again, the same infantry work and field craft and weaponry, and very, very little drill training. All action training from outside.
Is anything new?
To me, I learned to fire the Vickers machine gun.
Tell me about that.
Well, they just had this range set up, and they said, "Have you fired the Vickers?" I said, "No." He said, "Sit down," which I sat behind it. He says, "Two black buttons there," he said, "and two handles." He said, "Hold them at the target, look down the barrels and squeeze." And I blew a hole in a petrol tank about as big as a tea plate. And I thought it was fabulous. All them bullets going in the same place, you know. It was just unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
Anything else new? Anything tactical or types of exercise?
We used to do a lot of outside work, but we were out one night where, it was called, I always call them near misses, Jimmy Hill, who was my name Higgins, his was Hill, was always after me. On parade, it was always Higgins, Hill, Hooper, and so on. Jimmy, we were out on a night scheme moving through bamboos, which used to grow 20, 30 foot high, you know. And we were going through there and we were told to there'd be pop-up targets, assumedly firing at us. So when they pop up, you carry out the action of attack. So Jimmy pulled his bolt back, and unfortunately it fired a shot, which it shouldn't have done, but it kept on firing. And I think Sten guns used to have about 28 rounds in, and emptied all this 28 rounds of ammunition between his feet and my feet, because he was waving the gun, he was waving his this hand around, and he's waving this arm around, so it's firing all the rounds. Anyway, at the end of the day, the Princess Patricia sergeant, who was standing quite nearby, jumped in and grabbed the muzzle of the Sten gun and held it into the ground, and it fired everything into the ground. Otherwise, we'd have all got shot, I think. But after examination, they found that where the Sten gun has a rocking action, that when you pull the bolt back, it rocks back and locks. Squeeze the trigger, it releases it, and if you put it on automatic, it just stays like that, and the bolt action is going like a piston. They found that the spring that holds this thing up had snapped, so when Jimmy had pulled the bolt back, there's nothing could have stopped these rounds going.
So it wasn't his fault?
No, he didn't get caught martial or anything, but what he did get was he got his thumb in the chamber when the bolt went forward, it near enough chopped the top of his thumb off, so he was quite sore, as you can imagine. But now again, another near miss.
Any other incidents during the course, or any other types of training we haven't discussed before?
We went out on a recce, being an ex-NCO, because I still hadn't been made up again, so I went out, they picked me as an ex-NCO, because I was supposed to have known what I was doing. And myself, a corporal, and a lieutenant went on a recce to find our job, find the enemy, assess the numbers and their weaponry, and report back to our headquarters.
An exercise.
Yeah. So we went across the river, ankle deep, lovely, got across there, went and found the enemy, found their emplacement, artillery and tanks, and a rough estimate of troops available there, reported back to our CO, and we were told not to leave where we were because they needed to question us a bit more, which they did. And then we were told that there was going to be a night battle patrol go out, and we would be leading the battle patrols, three battle patrols, one lieutenant, one corporal, and one private, which was me, ex-corporal, being a private. Anyway, we went out, found the river, went across it, but what we weren't aware of, and we didn't know, and our intelligence section of our battalion then didn't know, it was a tidal river, and it was 6 foot deep then, so because we were jumping into 18 inches of water and finding it up here 6 foot, that was a shock. It wasn't our fault, we didn't get told off, but it was intelligence, hadn't got it on the maps as a tidal river. So, but we did our attack and did what we were supposed to do. And a lot of things we did there, which was, I never used to like, we used to do night patrols,